promoting sustainable crop production, a podcast series about sustainable ways to grow food in New Zealand. I'm Dan Bloomer from Landwise, and with me is Landwise's Luke Postuma, Hawke's Bay farmer Hugh Ritchie, Canterbury farmer and Landwise chair John Evans, Charles Murfield from Lincoln, and Alistair Holmes from the Foundation for Arable Research. Landwise has been around since 1999, helping farmers and growers develop and test new practices through on-farm trials, cutting-edge research, and delivering things to the farm and orchard gate. So today's panel discussion, strip-till and cover crops, is brought to you by our platinum sponsors, BASF Crop Protection, Hawke's Bay Regional Council, Vegetables New Zealand, Processed Vegetables New Zealand, together with Potatoes New Zealand, Horizons Regional Council, Balance Agri-Nutrients, Up Two Farms, BioStart and Plant and Food Research, all strong and long supporters of Landwise. So can we just start with each of you in turn, giving a little bit of an introduction on who you are and your links into strip-till and cover crops, please. So perhaps if we start with you, Hugh.
Thanks, Dan. And so, I'm a predominantly a cropping farmer based in central Hawke's Bay. In 2000, obviously involved with Dan at sort of different areas, but in 2000 I was lucky enough to be selected for an Nuffield scholarship, and in doing so looked at the Midwest and visited some conservation sort of proponents, and strip tillage seemed to be a program that they were using. So unashamedly we sort of copied some of the ideas and some of the tools we bought back in the suitcase and set about creating strip-till options at Drumpeel. We're doing about 200 hectares a year. We're either strip-tilling all the crops that can be in terms of squash, sweet corn, maize, and beans. And then from there, we've moved into direct drilling and obviously now looking at cover crops and managing sort of that overwinter period to better effect than what we currently are. So we've tried a range of equipment in the cover in the strip till areas. We had some pretty good stuff ups at the start, and we think we've got a pretty good system running now that really delivers benefits to the soil and to the bottom line of the farm. And so it's a system we will can carry on with.
Thanks, Hugh. So John, you sort of noticed some of the work that was going on and thought that strip tillage might fit your farming systems in Canterbury as well. What are the differences that you sort of experience with your farming type, your soils, your region? What's the differences between you and you?
Probably the big difference is that we're planting in half metre rows or 20 inch rows as opposed to the 75 centimetre. So when you convinced Dan that I needed to borrow some of your units, we brought them down and we tried it and it worked very well. But with his machine, it was actually set up for 30 inch rows, so you ended up cultivating more land than you weren't. So it wasn't until we managed to find a machine that was set up for half metre rows that we could actually really make it work, which was only a few years ago. And we did quite a lot. We put transplants in to strip tills. We've done direct seeded maize and sunflower. And with the strip tiller, we've done beans and prepared land for precision planting of beet, radish, spinach, you name it. So we're doing quite a lot. And so when I retired, which is probably now semi-retired, I retained my strip tiller, and it's been doing work, but actually doing some work for Far the other day, and Simon's wants to hire it again, so it's out there, and I've had several people on the phone wanting to use it, so I suppose I'm now promoting it to other farmers.
Okay, thank you. But Alistair, what's your background, and so where do you fit into the strip till and cover crops thing?
Well, I was first aware of strip till back with work that you were doing, Dan, up at Opie Station with David Clark around the year 2000. And since joining FAR, FAR's been undertaking trials looking at strip till and no-till establishment of maize for 10 years now at our Waikato arable site. And we've found consistently no significant difference in yield, but obviously benefits as far as cost in reducing the impact on the soil. And we've certainly seen in the last few seasons in the Waikato a rapid uptake of strip tillage, probably more caused by the messages the Waikato Regional Council is giving than anything else. We have also have leased a strip till machine again for the Gisborne region, which is seeing growers over there undertaking strip till of crops. And as John mentioned, we're undertaking some work with looking at strip till in hybrid radish seeds in the Canterbury region this coming season.
Okay, thank you. And Murph, what's your background and all this sort of thing as well?
So my background originally came out of organic vegetable production, and then moved into the research side of the game. And as part of kind of coming out of organics, cover crops are a really key important function in organics, particularly around nitrogen fixation, but also around soil health. So I'm very focused in this area and looking at how we can use the cover crops with something like strip tillage, particularly as we're starting to address reductions in agrochemicals and particularly around herbicides. I think the cover crops have an awful lot of potential to offer in that space.
Right. Thank you, Mick. So, Hugh, in your podcast, you were talking a little bit about some of the drivers that pushed you down the route. So you had the opportunity through Nuffield to see this in action, but why did you think, well, with my farm, this is the way I've got to go? You're muted.
We've continually cropped Dan Drumpeel, the home farm, since 1964. So coming through Massey and soil science, we knew the soil structure was getting impacted. We were doing more and more, you know, passes and bigger tractors to achieve the same result. So the driver was to do something different. I suppose the last straw was we had a peat block opposite Te Ariki College that had a lot of timber in it. The equipment didn't like going through it, and so you'd end up spending, you know, half a day running behind the cultivator with car trailers in the dust and the dirt, buddy chucking wood onto the trailers and then swap around at lunchtime, and the other guy would do the running. So we sort of came to the conclusion that it had to be a much better way, and the strip till sort of reduced the disturbance, let us get through it. We teamed up with some other farms in Hawke's Bay that were having issues with wind erosion and soil contamination of neighbouring crops. And again, joining with yourself, obviously, you know, there had to be a better way and let's find it. And so that was the driver. But certainly the focus on soil health, soil resilience and sort of moving forward even today with, you know, it links nicely into the cover crops and, you know, this fundamental word of regenerative farming, which is, you know, fundamentally seems to be about just improving soil health. So that's the main driver. If we can make sustainable soils for the long term and make the farm perform well without doing the disturbance, then we're on to, you know, a positive farming system, I think.
And we had a discussion at your farm a while ago now about the amount of energy you are using to maybe get a crop in the ground versus conventional cultivation. And yeah, that was quite stunning, the differences. So what were your numbers now? What do you think it cost you to put a crop in the ground in terms of, say, litres of diesel?
I think we're running at the moment in terms of getting the crop to establishment at under 10 litres a hectare. Obviously, if we have to do, you know, sometimes we'll go through the aeration and that can pull it up a wee bit, and we might go up to 15 litres a hectare if we have to aerate. But generally, if it's either strip till or direct drilling, we're under 10 litres a hectare for the establishment.
You remember what it used to be in the good old days of ploughing and beating it up?
Well, when we originally did those sums, I think we ploughed a 32 hectare paddock and it used, ploughed a, yeah, about 30 hectares and two paddocks, and it cost us 600 litres of diesel, and we strip-tilled the same area for 120.
So a quarter of the energy.
Yeah.
All right, thanks, Hugh. So, John, you mentioned a few things driving your journey. Is it the same kind of thing? Is it making your farming system more efficient? Is it some headache that you had that you got sick to death of?
Yeah, but it's the same. Really, I think the biggest headache I've had is convincing some people that I can actually put the crops in and get a good result. But yeah, definitely looking after the soils. You spend your, you've got your paddock and a bit of grass for a couple of years and you've built up the organic matter. Seems stupid to actually go and then plough out and destroy all that. So it's very much looking after the soil. And I'm sure that we reduce the amount of wind blow because of it. And we certainly help with the weeds because in between the rows is a lot easier to control weeds. You're not getting a lot of strike there.
Okay. Alistair, what are the farmers that you're working with saying? If you have some who are a little bit more interested and some who are a little bit slower, so they've got some more worries, what are you finding?
Yeah, I think that's definitely right. I mean, we're looking at the use of strip till as one tool in the toolbox. So we're also working with farmers who are considering reducing tillage, but also undertaking no-till. So as I said, there's been a rapid increase in the Waikato in the last few seasons in the uptake of strip tillage. And that's because the Waikato Regional Councils floated the idea of not allowing cropping within a number of metres of waterways. In certain parts of the Waikato, not allowing cultivation near waterways would rule out most of the paddock. So we've seen growers embrace the strip till system as sort of a halfway house where they still perceive they're getting the benefits of cultivation in the seed row, but not doing the damage in between the rows.
Yep. So do you think they might move to a full no-till system down the track?
I think it's definitely possible. I think, you know, we've had great success with working with growers in the south head of the Kaipara region embracing no-till. Where in, up there in specific circumstances, a number of farmers were farming directly above an Auckland Regional Council park and were highly aware that when those big summer dumps of rainfall came through, that a lot of their sediment was running into the regional park and realised that wasn't going to be a long-term future. And they went to no-till as a way of reducing that. So they gained confidence around the use of it. But like I say, I think a number of people have gone to strip till as sort of a halfway house. And I suspect when they see that as successful, the next logical step will be to consider no-till, especially in some of the lighter soils that we have around the Waikato and Bay of Plenty.
So those peaty soils or...
Yeah, I mean the soils in the Waikato are sandy loams and loamy sands. They really don't need intensive cultivation to be good for a seed bed. So they're highly suited to no-till establishment of crops.
Right. So just picking up on one point in there about retaining your residues and the soil health, and all of you have been talking about soil health all the way through. So how does the cover crop thing fit into that whole thinking as well with the work you're doing, Alistair?
Well, I think we're very lucky in the Waikato and Bay of Plenty because most of the maize that's grown up here goes to silage. So immediately following harvest of the crop, they're planting a cover crop. A lot of growers don't necessarily call it a cover crop because it's their annual ryegrass crop that they're using as a feed for their cattle, but that certainly has good benefits. And the advantage of planting it following a maize silage crop is you're planting it at a time of year when it will get good growth before the winter cold temperatures come in. It's a bit more challenging for the maize grain growers because they tend to be harvesting later and establishing a cover crop following the maize grain is more difficult because of the time of year, but also, as you say, because of the amount of residue left behind. So we're doing work looking at establishing cover crops in the standing maize crop before grain harvest, so they're ready to go after maize grain harvest.
Do you need a lot of different equipment to do that?
Well, I guess the short answer is no. I mean, there's all sorts of tools that can be used. I mean, we bought an old 16-run Aitchison tine drill and ripped a few legs off it and turned it into an inter-row seeder, and that cost less than $3,000, and we were getting great results sowing inter-row cover crops into maize at about sort of V5 stage. I mean, there are some big elaborate systems. The sky's the limit there, but you certainly don't, I don't think you need expensive equipment to do that.
Right. Murph, you're a bit of a machine junkie for things like this. What's your thoughts?
I'd fully agree with Alistair there. You know, you can go really complicated or you can keep it really simple. You know, one of my favourite tools is what's called the springtime weeder, just a whole kind of like a giant garden rake. And you can fit a pneumatic seeder to those, and they do a really great job of seeding, you know, these small seeds and then raking them into the surface. So you're getting good germination off them, because that'd be a key thing, you know, with doing this kind of trying to get a cover crop into an existing crop, is making sure you're getting that good establishment. Because if you just spin it on and leave it to hope, you know, you can have a good strike or you can have a really rubbish strike as well. But yeah, certainly it's kind of, you don't need to overthink this. You're just trying to get seeds in the ground and germinate. So, you know, you don't need to spend a fortune to achieve that result if you know what you're doing.
Now, you're operating quite a lot in the South Island.
Yep.
Do you find the difference, is the climatic difference is enough to make a big difference in the force of crops and the timing and how things can fit together?
Yeah, look, I mean, certainly as you're starting to try and integrate your cover crops into your cash crops, the timing can become really critical, and that's going to vary, you know, even potentially between kind of Northern Canterbury and Southern Canterbury, you know, as you know, with difference in accumulated heat units and all those kinds of things. So the main thing is not getting it in so early that it's going to the cover crop in so early that it's going to end up swamping the cash crop. So it's making sure you've got enough growth on the cash crop to start with before you start looking at putting the cover crops underneath them, and also the relative growth rates of the two. You know, if you've got something really quick growing like maize, you can put something small underneath it quite early on. You know, if you had something like barley, you wouldn't want to be putting a vigorous under it too early on, otherwise it's going to potentially smother the barley.
Right. So, Hugh, with your farm system, how do you see these things fitting together?
Well, again, it's a bit like strip tillage and sort of getting people to try it out. It's a mindset, really, if you sort of don't consider the options. I mean, I've just been thinking, listening to Merv and Alistair talking and just thinking, well, perhaps we could actually put a sort of a seeding system in behind the side dresser and actually oversow the cover crops as we're side dressing the maize. As a, you know, saving a pass and getting the job done. So I think you've just got to be open to the ideas, but certainly, you know, going forward, getting residue into the soil, lifting the carbon levels, which is going to drive, you know, microbial action and water storage capacity in the soils, the whole thing spins up as soon as you start adding carbon. So, you know, high residue farming was certainly a couple of the systems I looked at in the States. You know, it does get a little bit challenging. I certainly know when we blocked two pea viners with maize stubble, they weren't that impressed. So, you know, you've got to be, you know, mindful of the following crops and sometimes you have to do things differently. But certainly, you know, there's always a solution and there's always people out there that can come up with ideas that you can try. So to my mind, the mindset has to be right and then work forward from there.
And John, you were doing specialist seed production, which I presume brings another level of headache with some of the cover crop options.
Yeah, but we sort of, I suppose a lot of our crops, they're autumn sown, they'll be coming in after pea vines, so we'll be in early. So the pea vine will be off in November and we'll be planting at end of February or end of January, depending on the and carrots all beet. But so that gave us quite a window there to actually control any weeds. So you ended up with a very good stale seed bed. So it's almost, you know, you'd go in early January and strip till, put the fert on, and then you'd come back in again once or twice, depending, usually only once, and then you could catch a precision plant. So that was there, but probably the trickiest one is in the spring when you've sort of, you've got oats and oats or something, and then you've grazed it with cattle, and it's been a challenging year as a wee bit of pig. But so it's the same sort of thing. You've got to get in early as you can. But we've really had no problem. The biggest issue, I suppose, is out of pasture. Or we had rye corn once, and it was quite a big, dense crop. So those are the difficulties, and it's time. What you did with these squash, you know, spray out a strip well in advance helps, and that sort of thing. But yeah, there's nothing you can't get over. It's just get as you says, you need the right mindset and just sometimes sleep on it for a night and come back with a different solution.
So could you sort of describe that system for us, the full strip package, if you like, going from a grazed pasture into some kind of row crop?
Okay, Dan. Look, we found that especially coming out of permanent pasture, or even our maize ground would follow ryegrass seed crops. And so if you tried to shortcut the distance between killing the grass and strip tilling, you didn't get a very good result, especially with, we only use a tine machine. We don't use a powered, you know, rotary hoe type strip till machine. So I would recommend you need at least 6 weeks from spraying out the strips or getting the grass sprayed down before you actually attempt the strip till. So to, again, enable it to work within our system and keep a fair bit of grass up for the winter lamb program, we would then band spray 100 mil strips into the grass in front of the, you know, 6 weeks out. We could still graze with lambs and then come through and strip till, and then either post-plant and pre-emerge or immediately pre-plant, we would then, you know, round up the rest of the paddock. So GPS was obviously a pretty critical part with that, to get the strips in the accurate place and then get the strip tool to follow in the accuracy, and then obviously get the planter to follow in those lines. So certainly GPS was an enabler to make it work well, but not impossible.
And people often tell me they're scared of slugs in these sorts of situations. So what's your experience there?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can have, sometimes we don't do any treatment and have no effect, and other times we can have major effect. I mean, it's a seasonal thing. You have to monitor. And even if you do treat and you get a wet, damp sort of month, you know, you can have slugs, you know, climbing over everything. So, yes, you have to be mindful and keep on to it. But if you get a warm season, generally the mazes and things like that will grow out of it and come away quite well. Certainly we're very careful with seed treatment in terms of Argentine stem weevil and things like that, because you can actually subject the plants to a greater level of pest and disease pressure than they would otherwise get if you sort of mechanically, you know, working all the soil and taking all those pests and diseases out. But like anything, it seems to be cyclic, and no season's the same, so it's just one of those things you have to monitor. But it's not impossible.
And Murph, the organic approach to these headaches?
There's not much strip tillage going on in organics, possibly just because of the inability to use the herbicides in there. This whole system approach, you know, things like slugs, carabid beetles are major predators, biocontrol, it'd be interesting to see where FAR's at with looking at the nematodes for controlling slugs, because certainly over in Europe they've had some with those. Part of the problem is organics without the herbicides were reliant on tillage, so to me it's an interesting comparison looking at these organics versus a strip till or a no-till type system and seeing where their various strengths and weaknesses are. Yeah, back to you, Dan.
And Alistair, are you seeing people having particular issues, or again, it's if they want to make it work, they've got a high chance of finding a solution?
I think that's absolutely right, and I think you know, we've all had experience with people saying no-till or strip-till doesn't work, and when you sort of dig a bit deeper, they say, well, it doesn't work because we got slugs, or it doesn't work because we couldn't plant into that hard piece of ground. So if people want it to work, they'll make it work, but it's certainly something we say to people when they're doing strip-till or no-till, is they've got to be aware of slugs. Monitoring slugs is great, but they can come in overnight, and the challenge is to get a good coverage when you are monitoring to make sure that you're not missing problem patches in the crop. So we generally recommend to people to put on slug bait if they're doing a strip or no-till.
Okay. So people going into it, that's one case. When you've been doing it for quite a long time, are you seeing changes in your soil? How long does it take to see changes in your soil, do you think?
Well, it's quite a long process to be able to measure the physical changes in the soil. However, we set up a strip-till and no-till trial at our research site in the Waikato, and within 18 months, you could look at the difference in the soil between the fully cultivated and the reduced tillage, and the colour was clearly different. Now, when we measured that as far as carbon percentage, there wasn't a significant difference, but you could certainly see a colour difference, and see a difference in the texture, feel a difference in the texture of the soil after even just 18 months. So there are changes happening quite quickly, but it does take, probably takes 5 or more years before you can actually measure those changes empirically.
Hugh, you've got some paddocks you've been doing for basically 20 years. Have you noticed differences in the draft requirement for some of those areas?
Well, yes. I mean, I think initially, Dan, 20 years ago, you know, we had compaction, we had plough pans, we had, you know, degraded, you know, soils. You know, you were on site, we did VSAs on some of those soils. And so over time, again, we've seen a huge difference in terms of the amount of time, or the how often we have to aerate, which obviously is showing the resilience. Certainly you can see the internal drainage working a lot better through the ground. You know, I look at a, you know, ryegrass seed crop block strip-tilled into maize, and by Christmas you look between the rows and you'd actually swear the paddock had been cultivated due to the earthworm casts and the numbers of earthworms operating. So to my mind, once you get the system running and get build up, it's very good. I mean, I don't like to admit it, but certainly, you know, with the process crops we grow, you know, the resilience of the soil, if they end up having to harvest through wet, especially with sweet corn or even some pea crops, you know, the difference of the paddock's ability to stand up and not turn to a bog is quite noticeably different. Not that we want to advocate that, but you know, again, soil strength is soil strength. So, you know, I think you did the soil, the VSA tests at Drumpeel, compared with fence line and main paddock on a headland after BP's beans harvest, and you know, we were very surprised at the resilience of the soil. So, absolutely reducing the tillage and having, you know, I think as much as anything, we've got a rotation of crops as well. So we're putting legumes and cereals and you know, various things through the soil to give it that range of diets, I suppose you could say. But no, certainly we won't turn around and go backwards. You know, we might encounter problems, and again, talking about herbicide and acceptance of Roundup, we've just got to find a way through that, because I think Merv's comment is absolutely valid. I mean, I would not, you know, take an organic system and full cultivate everything over what we're doing now with strip tillage and direct drilling.
Thanks. So have any of you got questions of each other, just to, you know, steer things along?
Oh, one of the points I was thinking of in terms of the cover cropping and strip tilling, because you're on invariably on wide rows with these things, to me this is the ideal system to be looking at integrating the low-growing legumes, the clovers of the world, into these things, especially with your tall crops like maize. The potential benefits, and again, not just a single species of clover, as Hugh's just touched on, one of the key drivers of soil health is having a diversity of plants, both in space and time. So it's kind of like, you know, if you're going to put a cover crop in, don't put a single species in, you know, put multiple species in. So, you know, potentially looking at two or three maybe annual clovers for speed of growth and fixing nitrogen. And the potential benefits of this are really quite substantial. You know, there's some very interesting research showing that mycorrhizae in the soil are transferring nitrogen directly from the clovers into the crops like maize. So you're kind of getting multiple benefits there, you know, protecting soil against loss, improving soil health, biology, but also potentially boosting the crop quite significantly as well. So there's a lot of I think, considerable wins to be able to be got in this area.
Alistair, FAR's got quite a research program going, and this is one of the aspects that you've been investigating. Is that nearing completion, or are you just getting started?
I think it's nearing completion and just getting started. I mean, it's a very complex area, and you know, we often get people say, "What's the best cover crop to use?" And it really does depend. And you know, when we first started looking at different cover crop species in the Waikato, I was keen that we look at them a single species at a time so that we could really measure the difference they were making. But my colleague Sam quite rightly pointed out that mixes have major benefits, as Murph's just outlined. And one of the key ones is that if you put in a cover crop with multiple species and one of the species doesn't do particularly well, you've got other species in there that can pick up the slack. And we've certainly seen that in autumn sown species where it gets cold and one of them won't perform. So yeah, it's certainly a challenge to find the right species, but as we've said before, it's not complex to begin this work for growers. I mean, the first work we undertook looking at inter-row established cover crops in maize, we planted with an old 1950s Planet Junior. So there's certainly opportunities to carry out some of this work on growers' properties to get a feel for what might work in their system.
Right. I think that sounds like a pretty good place to leave it for today. So thank you all for your inputs. Really appreciate that this time of year, especially that you could give up some time for us to have the conversation. So the Landwise Promoting Sustainable Crop Production podcast series was brought to you by our sponsors, and we really do appreciate the generous support of BASF Crop Protection, Hawke's Bay Regional Council, Vegetables New Zealand and Processed Vegetables New Zealand, and bring the series to people. Thanks a lot, everybody.
Thank you for organising it.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Dan. Yeah, thanks, Dan. Thanks, guys.
Cheers.
Thanks, all. See you later.
Bye.
Bye.